All right, I'm going to live on YouTube. I'm calling this one "The Idiots Go Nuclear."
Yeah.
We should have a few people waiting. I just sent Chris Jones a message, and he's like, "Oh, are you streaming?" I was like, "Not my game. Just come on." Like my kids, think he's a superhero. So like when they play superheroes with their dolls, one's like, "I'm gonna be Superman." The other one's like, "I'm gonna be Jonesy." "No, I'm gonna be Jonesy." "No, Jonesy's got better superpowers. I want Jonesy." I'm like, "Jonesy has no fucking superpowers." I don't know where they got that idea. Like bad eyesight.
Yeah.
All right, we're going live. We're live so people can hear you drinking.
You're listening to War for Idiots, a podcast by idiots for idiots.
You can now talk and drink and slow.
Oh, if we can just start after I finish my cup of tea, that'd be fantastic.
Not happening, man. Oh, it's good. I've just checked the YouTube page out. You've got your eyes closed whilst you're drinking, and it's...
That's how good this tea is.
It's everything.
Oh, my God.
So I'm not allowed to eat chocolate while we go live.
You're definitely not allowed to eat chocolate. Okay.
Yeah, we'll see.
So can you give me the signal when we are good to start? Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, podcast listeners from all of around of the world, hello and welcome back to another episode of War for Idiots. As always, we are your hosts. I am Rich the Ignoramus.
And I am Mick, pulling up a different screen.
Good.
I'm the chump.
So well prepared. So
you're
well,
a chump.
You couldn't ask for a better partner. And we are indeed the idiots that you have been looking for.
You're not going to get one.
And today we are talking about nuclear strategy. Just a light.
Nuclear
strategy. Nuclear. Just a light little topic to make sure everyone has a great night's sleep once we finish talking
so
about it.
So good of you. Sorry.
But before we do talk about nuclear strategy, we wanted to thank you, all of our great listeners, for your ongoing support. This is, I think it's like the 11th episode for this season. We are past halfway for this season.
Number 12.
We have grown.
No, 11 it is.
COVID has made us grown physically. Metaphorically, we have grown as well. Matured. I think, you know, we're older. And we've reached more people. The network has grown, but we need to continue to grow. So you, dear listener, can help us in that. Please share this episode. Do what I do. Send it to your mother. Send it to your loved one. Send it to anyone.
Send it to Richie's mum.
But share it on social media, comment, get involved. We love the debates. We love the comments. We love doing this show with you, ladies and gentlemen. So spread the word, but don't spread COVID. And speaking of COVID,
Victoria, I was struck
down hard this week with the common cold. I went and did a COVID test. Incredibly efficient drive-through center here in Canberra.
Painful.
Got the results back. The one in Epic Park. Results back in just over 24 hours. You are negative for COVID. And I was like,
"You got results that I'm negative for COVID."
Yeah, it was really weird. I was like, "I don't care about Mick Cook. Why?" Anyway, how's your COVID going, buddy?
Mine's going great. You want to know why mine's going great? Say why. Say why, Mick. Why is yours going great? I know you don't know.
Why is yours going so great, Mick?
New computer. So I managed to find an absolute deal from a computer business down here in Canberra. They build and refurbish computers and sell them at fantastic prices. And I got myself a top-of-the-range gaming computer. I haven't got it hooked up to our podcast or streaming yet, but when I do... we're going to be in all the D's, like Ultra D, HD, Double D, everything. We'll be in all the D's.
So highly appropriate.
Precedent computing, absolutely brilliant. It glows purple when I turn it on. I don't know why.
Yeah, that's it's because of the mega RAMs.
And it's got liquid cooling in there. Now, I always thought water was bad around the computer.
Yeah.
That after this, I'm just going to get a spray bottle and spray some more water in there.
That's science, man. That's science. Yeah, of course.
So, excellent. So my COVID's going great. And your COVID sounds like your COVID doesn't exist.
No, it doesn't exist. I had the test. It's incredibly uncomfortable. The lady handed me a tissue before she inserted the ramming device up my nose. And I said, what are these for? And she goes, in case you want to blow your nose, cough, or just cry a little afterwards. I was like, I will do a little bit of all of those. Thank you very much. So
the nose is like right up in there.
That's it. It is. It literally, so COVID rests in the back of your skull, right? So they have to ram it through the brain and do a bit of a swab. But no, all clear and, you know, super effective service. And I gave them a bit of love on Facebook. That's the ACT Healthies. Thank you very much. But let's get on. I had
a swab like that once, wasn't the nose though?
Let's get on with the show. And before we do talk about tonight's topic, we need to just talk about one of our good sponsors, as you can see by the shirts we're wearing tonight, that is Good To Go Gear. Now, G2G Good To Go Gear is an Australian veteran-owned business that has been supporting customers for over a decade. Now, if you are into military, camping, adventure, workwear, or first aid, they have got a wide range that is ready to be shipped.
Or jocks. Sorry.
And then the range is developing every day. They got a new set of jocks.
Which they've got jocks.
If we get a pair of jocks, we must show them.
Wait, if we get a pair of jocks, I will model them on this show. We will lose all of our viewers, but not our listeners.
Our listeners that are skyrocketed to about 4 have just dropped down to 2. Okay, so you can check out their catalog at www.goodtogogear.com.au and get the best gear that is G2G. Now, they offer a 30-day 100% satisfaction guarantee and ship both to Australia and the US of A. So as I say, rhetorically, every time we talk, what are you waiting for? Go and check out Good To Go Gear. That's G2G Gear.
G2G.
That is truly good to go.
And yeah, we've got a first time viewer tonight. Long time listener. First time viewer. Joller H.
Hey.
I don't know how you say their name because they're one of those people that put X's everywhere, but good on you.
Welcome. Welcome.
It's great to see you watching us. Let me know what you think of the beard. Because to be honest, I've copped a bit of shit this week and I'm over it.
Yep. Yeah, good.
So
good.
This goes out to people who have been criticizing me, telling me to shave. Damien, Richie, someone named Richie.
This is not in the Dan. Show notes.
It's Dan.
Beard montage is certainly not in the show notes, Mick. I'm not sure where you're getting that from.
All right, I know people want to talk about nuclear strategy, but I'm just saying the beard staying, cut the crap.
All right. So look, a very timely topic to talk about nuclear strategy.
Yeah.
Time of recording, a bit of awkward tension around the world at the moment between two nations that both have nuclear weapons. So it is a timely topic, but something that we are going to deep dive. And to be honest, when we constructed the notes and did the research for this show, we're only really going to scratch the surface.
I didn't do any of that.
By that, I mean Mick didn't do any. I foresee that we will be doing a second part on nuclear strategy, this being the first part, because it's not a Tarantino episode. We don't want to start at the second part and work our way backwards.
Remember when we saw Kill Bill? That was great.
It was really good. Okay. So the first thing we need to talk about is what is a nuclear explosion, all right? Because it's all around this concept of making a nuclear explosion. It is dangerous, 100% right. Now, the depth of my topic research and my understanding of nuclear explosion stretches to this little Aussie movie gem that you might remember, Einstein.
Because he starts off in Tasmania.
As an apple farmer. And for those that haven't seen Young Einstein, it's a Australian icon, Yahoo Serious. Yes, that's his name, Yahoo Serious.
We are serious.
This is an Australian tale that, I don't know, you know, you could say it's a documentary. The story of Einstein. Apple farmer from Tasmania, right?
Who invents the electric guitar.
Who invents it. But so in this, and here's the concept, he learns how to split the atom, which puts bubbles in beer, and then he travels from Tassie to the mainland to then spread this knowledge. And then it's the concept of splitting the atom, right? So pretty much the same as Einstein's story. Young Einstein, an amazing movie.
It's a boy.
But here's the thing. So as a young kid, this movie, it was like, okay, when you split the atom, a big explosion happens. I learned that very young from this amazing Australian movie. And in my head, always it has been, right? Somehow they get an atom and they place it very carefully. And then there's some sort of shearing device, look at the screen, that splits that, cuts the atom like a set of scissors, and then that creates some sort of explosion. As a kid, I had this image in my head that surely, you know, when you talk about splitting an atom, it must be physically split like that. And based on the research that we've done so far, that's pretty much exactly how it happens. Not
science.
That's exactly how it happens. That's 100%.
No, you have a conventional explosion and you have an explosive lens that focuses it in on your... No?
No, no. It's like scissors. I just explained. Yeah. I know. But when we started doing this topic, I just was struck by, remember as a kid, you thought that's how they split the atom. You know what I mean? It was really funny.
You want to know something really, really weird?
Yeah.
In year four, I gave a presentation for show and tell on the molecular structure of an atom.
No, did you?
Yeah. And I
tell you nerd. What a nerd. What a nerd, man.
After that day, I did not ever give a show and tell on the molecular structure of an atom again.
Oh, man. What a
mistake. I was like, wow, like everyone's going to think I'm so smart. I found this thing.
Yeah.
The teacher was just like, and do you have any toys you'd like to bring in next time? Oh, yeah, sure.
Yep, boring. All right. So what is an atom? Okay. So let's go back to the extreme basics. So an atom is the smallest particle of a chemical element that can exist. So we are made up of, you know, 200 to 300 atoms, right? I'm not sure that's true.
That's a bit of a stretch. you're pretty tall. You're maybe 2 to 3 atoms. I'm 150. I'm 150 max.
An atom, right, is the smallest constituent unit of ordinary matter that constitutes a chemical element. Every solid, liquid, gas, and plasma is composed of neutral or ionized atoms, okay? And then when you look at the atom and what Mick would have explained as a child, you should picture, I think it's, is it from the, I don't ever watch the Big Bang Theory, but I think that, do they have a picture of the atom up there where it's a centerpiece?
And they use it for the transitions between scenes.
There you go. Okay. So it's a centerpiece with the waves that kind of go around it, right? Now, all of these things have a name and they have a place as part of the, and they all form the atom. So in the middle, you would have seen a bunch of sort of balls that are gripped together, right? These are made up. These are protons and neutrons, protons and neutrons are in the center of an atom, all right? So these terms will be important, protons and neutrons. And then surrounding the protons and neutrons are the nucleus of the atom, all right? So that is the circle, and then the balls that are inside of the circle. And then the rotations that go around the atom that formulate this atom are called the electron. Is the electron of the atom. Okay. So it's made up of four components, just a very sort of idiotic way to just explain what is the atom. Okay. And then what they discovered is when you split this atom, that's not funny. That's not funny what you just put on YouTube. Anyway, when you split.
That's just a direct quote of you explaining what an atom is.
I didn't say bunch of balls. I said two balls. You have two balls. I'm sure I have now. Okay. So when you split the atom per se, it releases energy, it creates an explosion. So the next question, how do you split an atom?
It doesn't create an explosion, creates a release of energy.
That's right. Sorry. It creates release energy. Now your next question is, how do you split the atom? Well, what happens is that there's a shearing device, right? Like a pair of scissors, and the atom sits in the middle and then that's pretty much it.
And when you punch all your balls together, it's really easy to chop them. It's like chopping a bag of oranges, really.
It's no longer a PG episode.
I wasn't going there. Oh my gosh.
The creation of this energy through the splitting of the atom can occur through two ways, right? And they both start with F. The first one is fission. Have I said that right?
Yeah,
good. Fission? Mission, yep. fission, all right, F-I-S-S-I-O-N.
This one.
So what is fission? Fission is the process where heavy atoms split into smaller, lighter nuclei, releasing excess energy, okay? So this can happen internal within the atom itself, or this can be induced from the outside. And the example is when a neutron is shot at a nuclei and is absorbed, causing instability and fission. All right. So this is where they literally split it. And the way they split it is pretty complicated. I'm not going to pretend I understand it. But what I do understand is this can happen internally, or it can happen through the process of shooting another neutron at the nuclei. Right. Yeah, so that is called fission.
These are conventional explosives around, with an explosive lens around a radioactive material to create that.
Well, no, not quite. Not quite. Yeah. Not quite. So... not quite. We'll go into it. So, and then the other F is called fusion.
People aren't here for the nuclear power reactors.
So there's fission and there's fusion. Now, fusion works in reverse. Some lightweight nuclei, when exposed to high temperatures and pressures, fuse together to form a heavy nuclei, releasing energy in the process. So you've got two ways to deal with an atom that create this release of energy. You've got splitting it, or you've got actually heating it up so high that it fuses together to then release the energy, which is quite interesting in itself. And here's the cool thing, right? As you were saying, in modern nuclear weapons, they use both fission and fusion. A single warhead can release more explosive energy in a fraction of a second than all weapons used during World War II combined, including the Fat Man and Little Boy, which were the two atomic bombs dropped on Japan. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But as you discussed, you know, how they then generate these release of energy, these explosions into a warhead is a science in and of itself. You know, they surround it with this. There's the primary and secondary explosion. There's fission and fusion. It's extremely interesting stuff. Slightly more detailed than my shearing explanation of it, which maybe that's a third method. I don't know. Well, if I was Trump, I'd say, hey, can you look into that and find out whether that's real?
Drink some bleach while you do it.
But what is known is that modern day nuclear weapons create a chain reaction. And a chain reaction is something you'll hear often when you read about nuclear and nuclear strategy, which is devastating.
A great John Farnham song, actually. I'd sing it, that would get copyrighted.
No, don't sing it. So one of the ways the chain reaction work is that fusion releases neutrons, right? These neutrons hit a layer of uranium surrounding the fusion. Thank you. Surrounding the fusion fuel, causing atoms in it to fission. This fissioning generally contributes more than half of the weapon's total explosive yield. So that's how a chain reaction within a warhead can actually result in just the increase of this explosion. And it's far from just creating fission. It's far from just creating fusion. It's doing the double F, which is not a scientific term, and creating this huge release of energy. So there you go.
I know the four Fs. I'm not sure if I know the double F, but now I know the double F.
So why is this important? So the reason why I wanted to talk about fission and fusion, not only because I found it fascinating, not only because I wanted to move beyond my shearing method, which I'll never get over, was because it's fascinating how these simple scientific discoveries, which evolve and get more complex,
binding energy,
they lead to something as catastrophic as the dropping of the atomic bombs on Japan. Mm. And then they lead to a complete revolution in regards to how we look at strategy, and that is nuclear strategy, all starting with this chemistry-based experiment of, wow, when we split this atom or when we fuse this atom, it releases energy. And I just found that it fascinating.
Probably more a physics experiment than chemistry, right? Like,
I think it's a physics and chemistry combined, physicistry. But here's the interesting thing when we talk about going into this strategy, right, is what is developed with atomic energy is not so much the destructiveness of the weapon, all right? And the case in point is that during World War II, the fire bombings of Tokyo were far more destructive than either of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And I got a clip out of an airspace magazine that talks about it. The title of the story is called, not story, the title of the article is called Deadliest Air Raid in History. Let me read this out. An aerial armada of 334 B-29 bombers took off from the newly established bases in the Mariana Islands bound for Tokyo. In the space of a few hours, they dropped 1,667 tons of napalm-filled incendiary bombs on the Japanese capital, killing more than 100,000 people in a single strike and injuring several times that amount. It is the highest death toll of any air raid during the war, including Hiroshima and Nagasaki. By comparison, the bombing of Dresden a month earlier had resulted in around 25,000 deaths. So I wanted to read that because often you think, oh, it's the pure power that nuclear bombs create. That's the thing that's changed. No, it's not the power. It's not the explosiveness. It's how fast you can get it there.
And it's also terrifying. It's also the immediacy of it, right? Like, so the Tokyo firebombing and the Dresden bombing, some of the most infamous ones, and they're extremely destructive because they created a firestorm, right? Whereas the nuclear blast sort of blows itself out and doesn't create further firestorms like them. So you're right. Like, you know, this is going to sound bad because radiation effects happen, but they're almost like a cleaner way in terms of immediate effect, as opposed to firebombing, which relies on creating a firestorm ripping through a city for an entire night.
So, yeah. I just found it very interesting because the first thing I thought was, hey, you know, it's all about this huge explosion that is now available. But it's not, it's more than that. And what we'll go on to find out is it's not even the explosion that is the most important part. It's the thought of the explosion and the concept of something exploding that is terrifying.
The package, right? So like the 1600 tons or so filled with napalm that got dropped on Tokyo, that wasn't one munition. It wasn't from two munitions, it was several munitions, right? You know, was it a Fat Man, Little Boy? That's two bombs.
Yeah.
And so just the way people could understand how destruction was being delivered as well. And, you know, people who love the term lethality right now, they look at that and they're like, you know, it's a jump up in lethality, like destructiveness.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's keep going with my show notes. Thanks.
So what we want to do is just quickly run through, it's time to nerd out. If you're listening to the show, you have to be a bit of a nerd. So we're going to nerd out a little bit with regards to...
Like, cool people have stuff to do on a Friday night.
The very start of...
They're a bunch of losers.
If we start at the bombings or the creation of the A-bomb and work our way backwards, where did the journey to the creation of the atom bomb and nuclear age commence? Well, it all started...
Fred Flintstone.
It all started with Fred Flintstone. Now, if you go to a website, there's a really good one. It's called atomicheritage.org. They've got a historical timeline that is just fascinating. It's a real simple read. Just gives you the dot points from top to bottom. And they break it up into their definition of ages of how this development happened. And for them, the first age they call early nuclear science, which is between 1885 and 1937. I'll give you some of the cliff notes from it. 1895, it starts when German physicist Wilhelm Conrad Röntgen discovers X-ray. The next step is 1998, where Marie and Pierre Curie discover polonium and radium.
Yeah, and it kills them.
So Marie Curie and Pierre Curie are absolutely fascinating people to me. Did you know that Marie Curie was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize? She was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize and the first person and the only woman to win a Nobel Prize twice.
In two different categories.
And she is also the only person to win the Nobel Prize in two different scientific fields, which is just...
I didn't know that. I just
what? Just, how? Why?
And crazy. And also, Pierre Curie was one of a number of people who had their skull crushed by a carriage. Like, he was ridden over by... Awesome carriage.
But a nuclear one?
No. I think it was a radiation one.
No, it was a nuclear one.
Oh, okay. I don't think it was.
Definitely. But the work that they did was utterly fascinating. And I read an article about someone researching her, and he writes, more than 100 years later, much of Marie Curie's stuff, her papers, her furniture, even her cookbooks are still radioactive. Those who wish to open the lead-lined boxes containing her manuscripts must do so in protective clothing and only after signing a waiver of liability.
Yeah, street accident in Paris, crossing a busy Rue de Fonds in the Acquia di Conti. He slipped and fell under a heavy horse-drawn cart, like one of the greatest minds, like him and Marie was probably smarter, right? She was probably the real brains. But it ran over his head, fracturing his skull. That's like you don't hear that much about some of the giants of science. Like everyone has a tragic story, right? But and you know, Marie Curie, she died of radiation poisoning. What they achieved, amazing.
It's pretty hectic. And the reason why I find that the fact that all of her stuff is still 100 years later, it's still, you know, dangerous to the human touch, was it reminded me of, did you watch the show Chernobyl that was released recently on HBO? Heard of Chernobyl, I assume. Really, I highly recommend Chernobyl for anyone who hasn't seen it. It's not what you think. It's not the...
Well, the Russian government didn't like it, mate. So I was like, oh, well, they're pretty good judges of my... No, mate. There was a good joke in a show I'm watching on Catherine the Great. It's a comedy. Yeah. And this is well before... This is like set in the 1700s.
Yeah.
And the Chernobyl Girls Choir comes in to sing at a banquet. Oh, someone goes, oh, aren't they lovely? They're glowing.
That's good.
It's good, pardon me. Mate, I've heard it's a brilliant show. Is it good?
So the reason why it's good is because I think it really, for the uninitiated, which is I, it really gives you a sense of the scale when you're talking nuclear. When the plant first explodes and they bring in an expert and the Russian government is just like, do this. And he's telling the consequences. This will be here for 1,000 years. Like the scale is just, it literally is mind blowing. Some of the stuff he goes through. And I found it just really confronting. Just like, wow. Yeah, he just drops stuff on it. But but you're right. Apparently, I read that the Russian government not happy with it. And they're making their own series to tell the truth of how Chernobyl actually occurred. And that was, of course, American influence. So that'll be a very interesting counter-narrative that comes out. Okay, let's go on with the timeline.
America had their own nuclear thing with Three Mile Island. Like, you know, it's, everyone gets one, not us.
So in the early 1900s... 1911, Ernest Rutherford articulates his model of the atom, which is what we just discussed, the center of which is the nucleus, containing the majority of the atom's mass and all of its positive charge. And then shortly after, well, not shortly, 1932, British physicist James Chadwick discovers the neutron. And it was in September 12, 1933, Leo Szilard, which we'll speak about him later, conceives the idea. Here we go. 1933, he conceives the idea of using a chain reaction of neutron collisions with atomic nuclei to release energy. He also considers the possibility of using this to make bombs. This predates the discovery of fission by more than 6 years.
It kind of upsets me. You know why?
Why?
Because that led to that guy. Who's that guy? He got jailed for beating his wife. He made a terrible movie called Chain Reaction about cold fission. Oh, I can't remember who it was. Christian Slater. That was a shit movie. Thanks, Leo Szilard. Anyway, keep going.
I remember the movie Christian Slater when he was a skateboarder. You know, he was a pro skateboarder when he was a kid.
Was he?
Yeah. Amazing. Anyway.
Pump Up the Volume. That was a good film.
Yes. I do remember that film. So this is the early ages of discovery of nuclear weapons. And it was an amazing period of scientific discoveries. You know, then what is amazing is that these were just scientists who weren't looking to create a weapon. They were just making these new discoveries about what is this new materials that they're making? How can they get energy from it? And all these other sort of side effects of, oh, if you split it, maybe it will release energy. And what sort of blew me away about this is, Within 50 years of German physicist Wilhelm Röntgen discovering X-rays, you've got the atomic bombs dropping on Japan. And relatively pretty short period of time for something that will absolutely change the world and revolutionize the way that we look at strategy going forward. So between 1938 and 1939, of course, the world is seeing a war unfold. And so things start to really heat up, no pun intended. This is where we first hear of the infamous Robert Oppenheimer. Now, Oppenheimer hears about the discovery of fission, and within minutes, he realizes that excess neutrons must be emitted and that might be possible to build a bomb. And then Leo Szilard, can't say that word.
Let's just call him Leo Z.
He hears about the discovery of fission. He immediately realizes that fission fragments, due to the lower atomic weights, could have excess neutrons that must be shared, releasing energy, creating an explosion. So the potential is there. These two gentlemen in 1939 are like, we can make a bomb. We can absolutely go for it.
I love that Szilard put in a patent, right? I'm putting in a patent for a chain reaction explosive device. And everyone's just like, it's actually a really good idea.
Yeah, yeah. Cuckoo.
You should do
actually
that.
Said no. They actually said no to start off with. They're like, we.
That's all like, lawyers do that though.
Yeah. No. The government. He's like, hey, I want to patent this and give you the patent. The US government's like, no. We're good. We don't need that. And then, sort of, what happens, right?
Next minute, 9:41. Hey mate, well, you got that little chain thing you're talking about.
So what happens is, on the 2nd of August, 1939. So this is all in 1939, right? It started Oppenheimer thinking, hey, we can make a bomb. In August 1939, President Roosevelt receives what is infamously known as the Einstein letter, warning about the prospects of an atomic bomb. Let's read about that. So the known as also the Einstein Szilard.
I said it so wrong. No, Leo. Oh, because it's Einstein. So Einstein Szilard.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, it was a letter written by that guy, Leo, and signed by Albert Einstein, and was sent to the U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1939. It was written in consult with other ones. Blah 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 blah. The letter warned. Here we go. The letter warned that Germany might develop atomic bombs and suggested the United States should start their own nuclear program. It prompted action by Roosevelt, which eventually resulted in the Manhattan Project developing the first atomic bombs. And then 1 month later, Germany invades Poland and World War II officially begins from a Western perspective, argument of when it actually did start. But it's just absolutely fascinating. The year 1939, huge leaps and bounds for the development of nuclear weapons, the impetus to develop the nuclear weapon. Like, hey, we've got, hey, remember Germany? Remember that First World War? It's about to get a lot worse. We need to develop this extremely quickly. So it seems like the real collision of science and military here, I thought was absolutely fascinating. What strikes me is just a month difference between Einstein saying, hey, I'm pretty sure they're going to develop atomic weapons soon. A month later, they invade Poland. Amazing. And it would be only two years after this letter is given to President Roosevelt that after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, America would eventually enter the war. And for those that love the fickleness of declaring war, this is my favorite declaration of war timeline. 1941, one day after Pearl Harbor, United States declares war on Japan. This prompted Germany to declare war on the United States, which then led to the United States to declare war on Germany a couple of days later. I just love it. Yeah. No, I hate you. Hey, you can't hate him. I hate you back. Well, if you're hating me, I'm hating you. Like, it's just, I love it.
My little lad when he comes back from daycare. Oh, this person's not my best friend today. That person's my best friend today. But tomorrow they'll be my best friend. He's like, mate, you understand international politics.
Exactly. All right, we're about to sum up what happens with the rest of the nuclear development. But before we do, I just want to quickly talk about one of our good sponsors, the Extra Specialist Group. Now, since 2017, the guys at Extra Specialists have been connecting Australian veterans to the entertainment industry, whether it's through consultancy, agency, productions, and training. Extra Specialists have been changing the face of television and putting those who have served on the big screen and into your homes. They've worked with Marvel, they've worked with Touchstone, Netflix, Stan, and so much more. Extra Specialists is the place to go if you want to get into this entertainment industry. So, if you have extra specialist skills, Mick's just walked away. I think he's just given up on the podcast. That's all right. Or you want to learn some.
Is anyone making like an old school army movie? Because I reckon I could go all right.
Oh my God. I've got to start this line again because that just threw me off. So if you have extra specialist skills or you want to learn some, reach out to Extra Specialist Group and get started now. You can check out their website at www.extraspecialists.com. That's www.extraspecialist.com. Mick.
Hey, mate, did you get a total realistic looking bearded colonel just walk past then? Like, wow, that guy should be in movies.
Oh my God, you're such an idiot. Such an idiot.
Right, this is the show for it, right?
This is absolutely the show for it. Okay, can you get that video lined up? So lots of things happen.
Live streams. Who would have thought? If you can build a nuclear bomb, you can probably live stream.
So lots of things happen between 1939, when the Manhattan Project gets the go-ahead, till eventually 1945 when the bombers drop. And we won't go through the detail. Lots of science, lots of experiments. But it reaches its culminating point on the 16th of July, 1945. There's an ongoing war, a catastrophic war that's happening in the West. What's happened at this time? Germany has already surrendered at this time, okay? And I think it's really important context. So at on 7th of May, 1945, Germany has already surrendered. When we get to July 16th, 1945, US troops have already landed at Iwo Jima and Okinawa. And by this stage, there have been vast aerial bombardments happening over Japan. And it feels as if the war is almost over, but who knows? You know what I mean? No one really knows if it is over, but it just has that feeling. And this is when finally, after 50 years of we first discovered X-rays to we have developed a bomb, this is when the atomic bomb is first tested out in Nevada, out in the desert. And this is where the famous Robert Oppenheimer has his famous quote about seeing the bomb for the first time. Have you got that lined up?
I've heard of it, but if I was there, I would have said, I've become death, the destroyer of this. I should be sharing it. So hang on, we're just having a little bit of upgraded security on my computer, not thinking that I just nearly typed my password and put it into the chat on YouTube. That would have been embarrassing. All right, hilarious. Here we go. Okay. Screen now. I am sharing and we're going to
hit play.
Oh, good. It's telling me what my default speaker is. And here we go.
He knew the world would not be the same. Few people laughed. Few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him takes on his multi-armed form and says, now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
So what
a bunch of jerks.
It's a pretty famous quote, and the reason why I wanted to just really quickly hit the wave tops on the development of the nuclear bomb, and then the testing of it, and then that famous quote, because I think it just sums up so well.
He's crying whilst he's giving that quote.
He's absolutely crying, and it is such an amazing way to describe how he's feeling. Because you got to remember, he hears about experiment, he hears about the science, and he has an idea, and he's like, I think you can make that into an explosion. And then a few years later, he is seeing this explosion and he realizes the potential. And just those words, man, I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. It is so striking. Yeah. And if you want to hear more about it, I first listened to it on Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. Does a big episode on this about Robert Oppenheimer and all that sort of stuff.
This is a way to a better podcaster, dude.
No, a worse one. Obviously not.
Oh, sorry, a worse one. we are definitely.
He'd be a good listener. So it's fascinating. So what happened? Okay, so such striking words. Less than a month later, the atomic bomb is dropped on Japan. As we discuss, little boy is the first one on August 6, 1945, drops on Hiroshima, killing between, and it's hard to know the numbers, but it's estimated between 90 to 160,000 people in the four-month period following its use. As you discuss, there's the aftershocks, there's the radiation that stays there. So it's really hard to tell exactly
how. Story about that little girl and the 1,000 cranes, origami cranes. Yeah, did you ever?
No, what's that story?
I Google it and I dare you not to cry.
Okay, let's not talk about it now. And then 3 days later, Fat Man is dropped on Nagasaki. Total deaths estimated by the end of 1945 in Nagasaki to be 80,000. And 1 month later, Japan surrenders on the 2nd of September, 1945.
That went out pretty well when you think about it.
So
he's wiped off the map.
So
we can probably go another month.
and man, there's a whole study on did it really make him surrender? And I won't.
We should do that.
Did the emperor have the authority to make him surrender? Was he forced into it? Did they actually do an unconditional surrender? There's a whole bunch of stuff.
The army going to do if he did surrender?
Yeah, but I remember getting to that point, and for me, it takes me a little bit of time to go through these notes and come up with the story and read. I'm not going to pretend.
I should probably read it before the show then.
But I remember texting you when I typed out those lines, and I was like, dude, I'm mega depressed. I was mega depressed, man. Can I just remind you, 38 minutes ago, we were talking about Yahoo Serious, okay? That's where we were, and now we're talking, and it's just
depressing. Yeah, I tried to cheer you up with my response that it's a heartwarming tale of death and destruction.
Oh, man.
Like, it is horrible. When you study the way that President Truman went through his calculus.
Yeah.
And the way that, there's a great, great book called Just and Unjust Wars by Michael Walzer. And he talks about the decision to drop the bomb there. And if you did a pure life cost calculus, they still come out in credit. Like, more people lived because the nuclear bombs were dropped. But having to make that decision, all right, if I can kill over the next month close to 200,000 Japanese people in two cities, I might save over a million Japanese lives and maybe, tens of thousands of American lives. Okay, so let's do that. And you're like, what? it's just horrible stuff. I like your little timeline you got here too.
Thanks, buddy.
You're getting organized, the early Manhattan
development. Yeah, so, good. And you know what? We're sort of running out of time. I've got some other important stuff I want to go into. But the debate that Mick just highlighted then, whether it was the right decision, it's probably one of the most debated and controversial topics in all of history.
Someone never gets an answer. You're never going to get an answer.
And there's so many to's and fro's. We're not going to scratch the surface here. In fact, we might even do one on military ethics and talk about this as a case study.
I do so much on military ethics on the Dead Prussian. It's one of the most topics we have.
Cool. Let's do that, because I'd love to talk about it because you have an immediate feeling. You're like, they definitely made the right choice for the reasons that you said. It saved lives in the long run, or they definitely made the wrong choice because it was so inhumane and they killed all these women and children. Okay, that's two of probably 40 different perspectives. Let's look through all of them and then try to be objective about it, which is always going to be hard when you're talking about something that's so emotional.
Yeah, and you throw in things where people say, well, they use the nuclear weapon as a deterrent for Stalin to stop going for the land grab.
Exactly.
Just the complexity of the decision.
Yeah. So we'll get into it. We'll get into it for another episode. It's going to be fantastic. All right.
Yeah, military ethics.
So,
we've got it.
So what does happen, though, when those bombs are dropped is the world enters – I visualize this as almost the gates. The world enters the nuclear age. The world enters the age of nuclear strategy. The game has changed. I think of
1950s people standing outside like their nuclear shelters. When I think of like it's time for the nuclear age, I get this image of this 1950s family standing out in front of their big
house. That's true. A bit of love we wanted to send out to a good friend of ours who talks about nuclear strategy, which we're going to dissect a little bit now, is our good friend Jazzy Diab.
Too impressive, to be honest.
Super impressive. We've known Jazz proudly for almost 2 decades now, which makes us all feel extremely old. But she wrote a good... She wrote a good chapter in a book that has just come out on strategy, a primer put together by Nathan K. Finney, another good friend of the show, another super smart dude. Anything he reads will very much make you smart. So let's talk about what Jazzy writes in her article.
Not anything he reads.
So did I say anything he reads?
Yeah, but it doesn't matter because if Nate reads it...
I think it doesn't matter because Nate ain't listening to this show, mate. Don't worry.
Okay. Nate, like when we say super smart people, you don't listen to this show. Jazz might because...
Jazz will because we told her we're going to
do it.
She better listen.
This book actually, was only just released on the 15th of June, so this week.
Brand new.
And I used it yesterday in a workshop with some young officers.
Very nice.
And provided it to them. I said, look, there are all these great books by Lawrence Friedman, Hugh Strawn, Colin Gray, all these fascinating books on strategy.
Yeah.
Read Nate's first.
Yeah. It's as it said, it's a primer. It's not saying it's going to be better than the other ones, but it's a primer
to get your head to where you need to be. So let's talk about Jazz's chapter. Fascinating stuff, hey?
So Jazzy wraps up really well the nuclear strategy in very sort of simple concepts and in a very easy readable ways. And she introduces us to a few concepts, which we're going to talk about now. And the first one, when we're talking about the nuclear age and we're talking about nuclear strategy, is this concept of first strike, also known as the preemptive nuclear strike. So the first strike capability is a country's ability to defeat another nuclear power by destroying its arsenal to a point where the attacking country can survive the weakened retaliation while the opposing side is left unable to continue the war. So this is probably the first obvious strategy for a nuclear developed country. Use your most destructive weapon in your initial knockout blow of your enemy. And that's essentially it, you know, and it kind of makes sense. I've got the biggest bomb. I'm going to use my bomb first, right? And then make it explode. It is not how it was used in Japan, interestingly, but it was how it would be used, signaled to the USSR during the entire Cold War. And this strategy makes a whole bunch of sense to me, this sort of first strike, this first strike concept. Knock out your opponent one
day. You aggressive bastard.
Well, it does make sense, right? But the concept is, the issue that we have is, what if your opponent, okay, what if the other person also has nuclear weapons? Problem one, okay, you just blast all the nuclear weapons first. Okay, that's a cool initial concept. Let's graduate it. What if they have enough nuclear weapons that you can't destroy them in the first strike? What this would mean is that they could retaliate. And you know what this reminds me of? And I think this shows how sort of futile my humor, my sort of thinking is. This reminds me, do you remember when we were growing up? It might not have happened in Tasmania, but there was a real dead leg and dead arm game going around.
Yeah, man. We punched each other in Tasmania. Don't worry.
I don't know. I thought you'd be focused on other things. Like
what? Like not having electricity?
Like your second heads?
You gotta say second cousins.
Okay, so
out of those two things, I know which one we were focused on.
So the kids would go around giving each other dead legs and dead arms. It was quite popular, right? I remember. I never ever gave anyone a dead leg or gave anyone a dead arm. Why? Because it was the retaliation. Because I knew that if I did it, then it was just that they could do it back to me. And I didn't want to have a dead leg or a dead arm. So it was this retaliation. Just reminded me of being a kid and retaliation.
Yeah, it goes very well with the Nauru debate on declaring war.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, Nauru.
Yeah, exactly. So where does the world stand in this current day about first strike? Well, interestingly, China is the only nuclear-armed country to have a unconditional no first use policy. India maintains a policy of no first use with exceptions for a response to chemical or biological weapons. Interestingly, France, North Korea, Pakistan, Russia, the United Kingdom, and the United States maintain policies that permit the first use of nuclear weapons in a conflict. However, Israel does not acknowledge the existence of its nuclear arsenal, so has no publicly known position. So first strike is still a strategy that's certainly there. And as you can see, all the differing nuclear powers have different ways that they have interpreted it and intend to use it and or not use it in the future. Terrifying stuff, right?
Yeah.
So
horrifying.
The retaliation. Okay. This is known as the strategy of the second strike. Right, straight from Jasmine Diab's mouth, she writes, the ability for a state to be able to endure a first strike and maintain a nuclear capability to retaliate and respond. So this strategy is seen as less aggressive in nature. It's much more defensive as a strategy. But what it led to was a few things. It led to a massive proliferation of nuclear weapons, because no longer do you just need your fat man or fat boy or whatever it was called. You need thousands of them. So that during the first strike, they don't all get destroyed. You still maintain the capability to do your second strike and your retaliation. It's not all destroyed at once, right?
And I can relate this to a childhood game as well. Have you ever played Who Can Hit the Softest?
No.
It's a trick game, right? My brother, who watches the show every now and then, he'll probably fly up from Tassie and punch me for this. But what you do is you say to usually it's a younger sibling, right, who is a little bit gullible because they're younger. You say, who can hit softest, you go first, and they do a really gentle punch, and then you absolutely thwack them as hard as you can, and you go, you win. That's second strike retaliation.
That sums it up really well. Well done.
They fire one nuke at you. You fire hundreds.
Yeah, exactly.
Before your cities and sites are destroyed.
Exactly. And not only is there a proliferation of the amount, there's also a proliferation of the methods of delivery. And America achieved the nuclear triad, which is what they call it, where they can deliver nuclear weapons by air, land, and sea.
Mm. And this is how it led to intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Yeah.
I mean, once we crack the hypersonic capability, modern missile technology, nuclear weapons are, you know, they're minutes away from anyone.
Yeah.
Right now. Yeah. You know,
terrifying. It's terrifying. Yeah. And then something else happens when the concept of second strike hits the table and retaliation. Countries that have no nuclear capability, like Australia, suddenly there is a whole bunch of alliances happening real quick, right? So it's fascinating. Nuclear weapons not only changes the strategy, the statesmanship, but suddenly it's changing geopolitics as well. Yep. Everyone needs to have a side now, because you either have nuclear weapons and you need to have enough that you can do a second strike, or if you haven't got any, you need a side with someone that has
really
some.
Really hard to be Switzerland.
Yes, yes.
And they're lucky, because no one's really going to do a nuclear strike on Switzerland, because they'll mess up Europe, because of where Switzerland sits in Europe, right? But it's really hard for a lot of nations out there to remain neutral. You kind of have to ally yourself with a great power at this stage.
Exactly.
Rather than try and play, you know, the middleman against, you know, be the middleman playing each other off against each other.
And then when you have first strike, when you have second strike, the next evolution is derived out of this logic, right? So when you ponder the concept and consequences of first and second strike, knowing that if I strike first, then my opponent will be able to equally destroy me. But if my opponent strikes first, then I'll be able to equally destroy them. And all of the alliances that now currently exist in between, you have the concept of mutually assured destruction. Which is
mad,
the aptly
man.
Fit
that
mad.
Is so mad.
And I want to, I can't remember who said it, but at the very top, someone on YouTube.
Yeah, right. Here we go. Yeah, Luke.
Legends of History. Greetings. Like, such a mad topic on the table this evening. Yeah, so well done, Luke.
Luke, great friend of the show. Thanks for tuning in every Friday night, mate. It's great to have you with us.
So mutually assured destruction, a doctrine of military strategy in which a full-scale use of nuclear weapons by two or more opposing forces would cause the complete annihilation of both the attacker and the defender. All right. And it's fascinating. So what happens when mad hits the table is people realize that, oh man, this is really bad. This is really bad. And
This is planet death.
This is really bad. And as a result, this whole concept of nuclear war changes, because, okay, first strike, I need to have the big bombs so I can strike them instantly. Yep. Okay, here are your big bombs.
Need to wipe out Moscow. He needs to wipe out Washington. Everyone else is like, okay, just if you guys can just keep it there.
Yeah.
And then Turkey's like, what are you guys building here? And then Cuba's like, hey, there's some boats coming our way.
Exactly.
Weapons everywhere they can.
So at its core, what happens is that this concept of deterrence hits the table. It's the next evolution, okay? And Thomas Schelling writes about deterrence. It's a concept that military strategy can no longer be defined as the science of military victory, which I thought is fascinating. It's no longer about winning. Okay. Instead, deterrence, it is argued that military strategy is now equal, if not more, the art of coercion, of intimidation and deterrence. Schelling says the capacity to harm another state is now used as a motivating factor for other states to avoid it and influence another state's behavior. To be conceived and deter another state, violence must be anticipated and avoidable by accommodation. So this is really fascinating, right? Because nuclear weapons now, it's not about the first strike. It's not about the second strike. It's not about destroying each other. It's about having them to not use them. We have these weapons so we don't have to use them. We have these weapons to deter you to a way and to do things that we want you to do so we don't have to use these weapons. It's just a fascinating, fascinating evolution of it. And again, Jazzy in her chapter, got a really cool quote, which I think sums it up really well. Here we go. So how do you do this? Here's the quote. What is the only provocation that could bring about the use of nuclear weapons? Nuclear weapons. What is the priority target for nuclear weapons? Nuclear weapons. What is the only establishment defense against nuclear weapons? Nuclear weapons. How do we prevent the use of nuclear weapons? By threatening the use of nuclear weapons. I just think it's so crazy.
It's one of those things, like, you know, very rarely do I look at something like my my liquid cooled PC and say, I wish someone could uninvent you. But nuclear, like, and I understand nuclear power. And for those people that are familiar with Jazzy's work, Jazzy's, she works in an association called Women in Nuclear in Australia. She was leading it for a while, I think. And she works with another great Jazzy who does nuclear scientist as well. And they talk about the benefits of nuclear power. Like, nuclear technology doesn't have to be bad. But we did what people did, like, the first time someone picked up a stick and they went, oh, wow, this is a tool. I'm going to go bash someone over the head with it. And then later on, they realized they could use it as a lever and stuff, right? We created nuclear technology to kill each other. And then like, oh, it's also got benefits, but I might just stick it now in my submarine.
Yeah.
In a missile first, you know?
And there's a really good sort of debate happening on YouTube between Saberwolf and Lens of History about the concept, and we won't even scratch the surface of this, but of use of nukes in Korea. Would this have actually, you know, shortened the Korean War? Would it have shortened the Vietnam War? Would it have changed it?
Nukes were considered for the Korean War. You know, MacArthur pretty much lost the job because of that, right? Yeah. So it's not that these weren't considered. It's just that even by the Korean War in the 50s, people were starting to understand the use of nuclear weapons has to be in the most extreme of circumstances. And to be honest, the people fighting the Korean War, it was a proxy war, but by other powers in someone else's backyard. No one who was leading the fight on either side of the Korean War had enough stake in the game to use nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
I don't even think China had nuclear weapons by that stage. They might have had access. I don't even know if the Soviets had nuclear weapons by that stage. It might have only been the US. But, you know, US didn't have enough of a stake in Korea to say we can probably use a nuke.
Yeah, exactly. So look, the development of nuclear strategy and, you know, the one that exists today is deterrence. There is nuclear weapons in submarines that are cycling the world all the time. There's sites everywhere that are spread out. It's prolific. And it's just fascinating. You know what I mean? So what fascinates me is the logic of it. To be successful in nuclear strategy, you must have nuclear weapons. Okay, point A. You must have these weapons so that you assure that you never have to use these weapons. All right. Or else someone else may use their nuclear weapons against you. It's just crazy. It's crazy. It's, you know, it's like having a quick reaction force. You know, you hope you never want to have to use it, but you don't want to be caught without having one. And that's the concept of it. And, you know, there's a real interplay that you can get lost in the difference between mutually assured destruction and this concept of deterrence theory. But I just find the whole thing fascinating. And when you think about the journey and then, you know, back again, the discovery of X-rays through the development, Oppenheimer's quote, the destruction that was caused by it, the hyper-acceleration of the damage that these things can cause, mass proliferation around the world, to come to a theory that we don't want to use it, we just have it there just in case, it's just, it really does sort of rock the world. But there's one more evolution of it. And again, as Jazzy talks about, right, all this nuclear strategy was born at the end of World War II. It developed during the Cold War. And the big thing about the Cold War is that it was bipolar. There was two superpowers that had these weapons. And so it was like, don't do it or I'm going to do it. Yeah, okay, cool. And all that sort of stuff. Yeah. But the world we live in now, as we've discussed many times, is no longer a bipolar world.
It's taken its medication.
It's had its couple of hours of therapy and it's a multipolar world. Many of these poles have nuclear weapons. And as Jazzy writes...
You don't mean Polish people by that. You mean... Yeah.
So who has it? We sort of talked about it before. Jazzy writes, the challenge of deterrence in a multipolar world is that the global community relies on a rules-based global order as agreed through the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. Yeah. This treaty formally recognizes five nuclear weapon states, USA, Russia, UK, France, and China. So there's five recognized ones. However, there are challenges to this treaty. Three states, India, Pakistan, and North Korea, are not signatories to the treaty and have declared that they do possess nuclear weapons. And as we said before, additionally, Israel, that's number nine, is one state highly likely to have a nuclear capability. However, this is not confirmed. That's a lot of poles to have a lot of nuclear weapons out there in the world. And if you want to really understand how many nuclear weapons exist out there, I found a great website, armscontrol.org, under their fact sheets on nuclear weapons, who has what. Here are the numbers.
This is still scary. This is less than I thought.
But it is less than you thought.
Yeah, far less. But it actually is less than what was existence in the 80s, right? Reagan and Gorbachev led a strong program of denuclearization.
But how much is too much? I mean, that's the question, right? You know, how much is...
Okay, well, I think the United States and Russia are definitely too much. North Korea definitely has too much. They should have
none. Yeah. No, but here's the point. You know, when we talk about Japan, and okay, that was, you know, Japan, World War II, a long time ago, that was two bombs. So how much is too much? You know what I mean? America, so listeners, let me just do the numbers for you. We'll do them in ascending order, right? North Korea has 30. Israel has apparently 90. Next up, India, 140. Pakistan, 160. The United Kingdom, 200. China, 290. France, 300. And you're like, okay, look, you know what? Hundreds of nuclear warheads, too much. I'm happy to say that. I don't say my opinion often. I'm happy to say that. Then we get to the big ones. The United States has 6,185. And Russia has 6,490. And Mick, I hate to agree with you, but I think that's too much.
Mate, it's, you know what I really like this map that you've got, but you know, I really hate it.
I drew it. Yep.
Okay, well, I hate it more now. But, the colors on it, right? Like, so it looks friendly. And like these
and the people, writing's nice. You're right.
These people, armscontrol.org, are not pro-nuclear weapons. They're pro control of these horrible weapons, but they've just done such a good graphic. You sit there and go, oh yeah, you forget every single number there represents the complete and utter destruction of the planet.
Absolutely. And you know, and for those that don't know nuclear weapons, I don't really know them, but I can tell you now, a modern nuclear warhead compared to what was used in World War II, not even comparable. Thermonuclear weapons now,
oh my God,
the ones that use fission and fusion, as we discussed before, are just mind-blowingly big.
Your mind brain will be blown like
easily,
literally out the back of your skull, and then your skull will disappear too.
And if you want to, you know, those numbers, those are just the raw numbers. There's a certain percentage of those that we know are being dismantled. Certain percentage, you know, they have a certain amount that are just as defense. So there is some context behind those numbers, but still pretty large amount of numbers.
Really, really interesting about these.
Yeah,
This is all public domain knowledge, but from the systems that the US and Russia use in terms of the computer systems, they're old systems. They're not like a modern computer. Some of them are just the old, you know, 3-inch floppy disk style computers. One, because they're not networked in a way that can be attacked, and two, like, costs a lot of money, right, to upgrade your nuclear infrastructure. You've got to be sure that it's secure. And these old systems are secure, but they're old and run down and no one does hardware for them. Because, you know, a microchip is like this big, I guess, for those types of computers.
And I like, I really like on YouTube, Josh has brought up game theory and the concept of the prisoner's dilemma.
Yeah, mate. Well, if the prisoner's dilemma was applied to nuclear strategy, the world would have gone nuclear in the Cold War.
Yeah, no, that's true. Look, we won't get into it, but I've got a confession. I am obsessed with the prisoner's dilemma.
It is always in your interest to stop in your mate.
Yes.
It's both our interests to remain silent.
I would so stab you in the back. I'm sorry. We would both manage to spend the longest time in prison.
Yes, that's right. We have, in our younger days, we've spent some time in certain types of extra duties together because we are terrible at the prisoner's dilemma.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, look, that was really fun. Ladies and gents, there you have it. That is our take on nuclear strategy. And we haven't even scratched the surface. You know what I mean? We just really was a quick introduction. I would love to do a follow-up on nuclear strategy. I would love to do a follow-up on especially the tactical, the proliferation of tactical nuclear devices, that is the deployment of nuclear weapons by soldiers in combat. You want to read about a cool one, you can read about Davy Crockett, which a lot of people, and not Davy Crockett, the infamous American folklore, but he was real. it was real. But the Davy Crockett nuclear weapon that was developed.
The Davy Crockett. That's a recoilless rifle, isn't it? That
shoots a warhead.
But it doesn't shoot it far enough to escape the blast.
So I wanted to bring it up because that's one of our lecturers said. I did a bit of a reading about it. It does shoot far enough to get out of the radius of
Because like we were taught that at uni.
Yeah, I remember.
Everyone's just like, that sounds really stupid.
Yeah. No, you can look it up. It's terrifying stuff, you know what I mean? And it may, you know, there's people who are pushing that we can make nuclear sort of the chemistry and physics of nuclear weapons down to the tactical level so that it can, you know, instead of your gunner in a section, you've got a nuclear weapon that you can potentially destroy a lot of stuff with. It's pretty terrifying.
The opposition officer on the gun line giving orders to load the 155mm nuclear weapon because the infantry battalion needs some danger close nuclear weapons. But if you were leading a battalion, I would definitely do danger close nuclear weapons for you.
Good. Thank you. I'd appreciate that. All right. Have you got any final words on nuclear strategy there, Mick?
Hey, look, I think, this week I did a class with some people on strategy, not specifically nuclear strategy. And I talked to them about what I like to call, lots of people call it the strategy equation, ends equals ways and means. A lot of people claimed strategy was dead because of nuclear technology and nuclear weapons. But what you kind of got a little bit of a feel from us, but please don't take it from our word. Go and read Jazzy's chapter, is that nuclear weapons technology just reframed how strategy worked. So it didn't actually change that equation. It didn't change the ends, the ways and the means, it the way they relate to each other.
Yeah.
It upped the scale on what the means were and the ways in which you could use them and what the ends looked like, because your objectives weren't gone, because you could still have an objective that was the mutual destruction of both civilizations. Or of total destruction. That's still an objective. That's still a strategy. So when people say, nuclear weapons mean strategy is dead, that's not true. What it means is that your hope for a desirable outcome is less, but you can have a strategy that you aim to lose it. And we see that with a lot of terrorist activities, right? So any type of suicide mission is based on a strategy of not coming back. Yeah. So it's really interesting. So don't look at, I know people look at nuclear weapons as changing, the nature or the idea of strategy. It doesn't. It just ups the ante, right? And your chances of a favorable outcome are a little bit less.
I think it doesn't, it doesn't change the very concept of it. You know, the rise of China doesn't change the concept of strategy. It's just a new calculus that you need to put into the equation. You know what I mean? It's all.
And I think nuclear strategy is one of the best ways to learn strategy.
It really is, because what it does is, you know, we did an episode in season one on the classification of war, and we talked about total war and just war and is this a full war and all that sorts of stuff. It's instead of a war being something that's fought between two nations in a faraway land, you know, it is, war is now an extension of strategy, it's an extension of geopolitics. And with nuclear weapons, your country's existence, your state's existence is also on the table as well. So in many ways, as you said, it just ups the ante. It just changes the conversation slightly. Well, ladies and gents.
Great idea, Jess. Sorry, Jess, just threw in that thing about getting Jazz on the Dead Prussian. So for those people that like to listen to me do some talking every now and then, some of the authors from On Strategy, a primer, the editor have agreed to come on and do some promotion of the work and do some interviews. And so Jazz is definitely one of those people. There's a couple of other Australian authors on there, Jenna Higgins, Joe Brick, and also I want to get Nate. So for those people who are hanging out for the TDP, hopefully, I've pretty much got the whole book, trying to get the whole book on there, because really that gives me like 20 episodes. Yeah. And I don't have to worry about content.
And if you are like me and you're like, oh man, I can't afford this book, man. Just follow our socials, click on the link, and you can download it for free on PDF and read the whole thing.
Write notes on it without like messing up the pages.
Yeah, you just write on your laptop. Okay, cool.
That was a really big end. Hey, any final thoughts from you on nuclear strategy?
Well, if you believe it's real, then
Mate, you're gonna get, like, people already think that we believe 5G.
5G is giving you COVID.
So, ladies and gents, whoever listened to our last episode, we have had people reach out to us and say, you know, what is your take? Because, you know, it's hard from the title of the shows we give them for people to understand our position.
Yeah.
Generally, Rich's position is...
I give no position. That's my default.
And generally, my position is someone is going to be an idiot by the end of the show.
Good.
But yes, we do have a position on nuclear strategy. It does exist.
All right. Look, well, we hope you have enjoyed this episode on nuclear strategy. We hope we've just planted a seed of interest in this concept. You probably know more about it than we do, but hopefully you've enjoyed our take on it. Hopefully you agreed with some of it, but most importantly, hopefully you haven't agreed with it, because if you want to have a debate, we're always up for it. Hit us up on socials
and
tell us.
Well, there'll be an opportunity in the future to potentially have a discussion group. So keep your
ear on nuclear strategy. Keep your
nuclear strategy. We won. There might be several topics we might think of doing. Hey,
that's right. Okay, but if you do like it and you did enjoy this, please share it with all your friends. Share it with your family. Send it to them on Sunday. Hey, Mum, I got this amazing light listen for you. It's on nuclear strategy. Have you ever heard of fission? Yeah. Here you go.
Hey, if you don't like it, if you don't like this show, Mum, the best way to do it is to jump on iTunes and give it 5 stars.
Yeah, exactly. And then I'll never send you another one again. All right, Mick. Hit us up for some socials.
Cool. So go to Facebook and search War for Idiots and you will find our Facebook page. Like us, share us, and stick us in your ears. You can find us on our individual Twitter pages. You can see Richie looks like himself at Richie_TTT. Okay, so that's the big tall guy with the headphones on in his photo. And if you're looking for me, it's at Mick_Cook, and I am the Indiana Jones looking mofo sitting pretty. That's my profile pic. You can generally also tell the difference between the two of us, because I'm probably having a go at someone, whereas Richie's having a conversation with someone.
The guy fighting with you. I'm the guy giving you a pat on the back.
I've decided to take on the government this week, so it's been fun.
I saw that. So I'm looking for a new co-host. If there's anyone out there.
Because I'm about to be extradited to a black site. there's also the middle road, which is War for Idiots, which is at War Numeral 4 Idiots. Jump on Twitter. Hey, follow us. Share us. We also appear in all your pod channels. We're not just a YouTube show. In fact, we're primarily a podcast because we know a lot of people are time poor. So you stick us in your ears when you're in the car. So follow us on iTunes, Stitcher, Doozer, Google Podcasts, Google Play, anything. Wherever you get your good pods, we are on there. You'll be amazed on all the ones that we're on. And we would love to hear from you. We're on Spotify. We're actually doing quite well on Spotify, actually. So, ladies and gents, share us because we're surprised at how popular we are now. But we can always be more popular.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. All right. Leave a review. Share. Keep the support coming. You are the reason that we do this. And until next time.
The reason I do it. I love the sound of my own voice.
Until next time. This is Rich.
And this is Mick.
And this is Rich. And remember that we may be idiots.
But so are you.
War for Idiots is a TDP production. All opinions expressed by individuals on the podcast are those of the individual and not necessarily representative of any other organisation. The music used during War for Idiots is Fireworks by Jazzar and is used under an Attribution Share Alike 3.0 international licence.